Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it'll be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Now, this afternoon, we have a fascinating guest. His name is Gregory Dixon. We'll take calls at the half hour. But right now, of course, you remember our telephone number. Here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295, and out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, now, of course, we've had Mr. Gregory Douglas as a guest in the past, talking about his book, Reads Aside. But this evening, we're going to be talking about his book, Gestapo Chief, because, of course, he wrote a book about Heinrich Mueller. Most Americans, of course, believe that, the Nazis were really bad guys during the Second World War, and we punished all the Nazis at the end of the Second World War at Nuremberg. But, of course, there were many, many Nazis who actually came to work for the American government, and one of them was the head of the Gestapo. And Mr. Douglas had the opportunity to meet Heinrich Mueller when he lived here in America. Well, I'm going to let Mr. Douglas tell you about Heinrich Mueller, the Gestapo chief. How did you happen to become interested in him, Mr. Douglas?
Well, actually, I had a friend of mine. I was living in Palo Alto, which is, you probably know, is right over the hill from you. I was working at Stanford University at that time, and a friend of mine who was in the hospital system there. I had been in the German Sicherheitsdienst during the war, and I had gotten acquainted with him, and so we got to talking about various personalities, and he mentioned some friends who'd come over with him under Paperclip and Operation Bloodstone, and so that's basically how it got started. Eventually I met this fellow who was living up in Piedmont, So it went from there, basically.
All right. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what Operation Paperclip was? Because most Americans are totally unaware of the fact that we brought a large number of Nazi war criminals, if you want to call them that, to the United States after the Second World War. What was Paperclip? What was Operation Bloodstone?
Well, Paperclip and Bloodstone there's a number of other ones. Were various programs instituted by the American government, the United States Army being one of the instigators, and the Central Intelligence Agency being another. And this was the idea that since the Cold War was now going on, the idea was to bring these people, German specialists in military equipment such as rocketry, jet planes, and so forth, to come over and work, and then also they wanted to get a hold of anyone that had any knowledge of Russia, the communists, and so forth. Now, General Galen, Reinhard Galen, had been head of Foreign Armies East in the German High Command, and he had quite a bit of knowledge of German tactical material, like battlefield, order of battle. He wasn't as useful as he might have been. We bought his files for quite a bit of money, and then discovered it was mostly army units in Russia that had been disbanded. And in 1948, when the CIA took over the Galen organization from the army, they began casting their nets wider, and a man named Wilhelm Kirschbaum, who was one of the CIA's top recruiters, had been in the Gestapo, had been a colonel, had been running this secret military police, they called it, which was the army version of the Gestapo. And he knew Mueller. Mueller was at that time in Switzerland. So through Kirschbaum, the CIA contacted Mueller in Switzerland, in Geneva, and asked him if he would be willing to stop working for Swiss intelligence and go to work for them. And they made a good deal for a certain amount of money. And that's basically what it was. Mueller was a Bavarian. He'd been a combat pilot in the First World War when he was 17 years old. He'd gotten quite a number of medals. He had gotten out of the war and had gone into police work in Munich, got into the political police department, and he was a great prosecutor of communists and also the Nazis. He was a big enemy of theirs. And he eventually went to work for the German Third Reich administration, and they gave him a job as head of the secret state police, which is was not a Nazi organization. It was a political organization. It was a military, a state organization for the Prussian government. And he built that up, and he was the first to use the IBM punch card method. And he worked with IBM, as a matter of fact, throughout the war with the Swiss. And he built up these early computers, the card punch type computers. And he had built card files on practically everybody. He was an indefatigable worker, and well known for his anti-communist activities. When he took over the Gestapo, there were at least 20,000 Russian spies working in Germany. And by the time he'd finished, there were very, very few. So we used his expertise. And he supplied information to the McCarthy people and to the various sundry intelligence agencies. He knew almost everybody in Germany. He had a phenomenal memory. And his files and his information was extremely valuable to them. And that's basically what Mueller's role was.
All right, fine. Now, of course, during the war, he, though, was a very efficient police officer running the Gestapo, helping to maintain the Nazis in power. Was he rather pragmatic in his approach?
Totally pragmatic.
The Nazis were in the winning position, he was going to be with them. In fact, wasn't he right with Hitler almost to the very end there in the bunkers?
He was. In the beginning, Hitler didn't like him because he had been one of the Nazis' worst enemies down in Munich when they got started, but later he realized Mueller was nothing but a very good professional policeman is what he was. And in the end, Mueller was one of the few people who stuck. After the bomb blast in 1944, when somebody tried to blow Hitler up, Hitler gave Mueller the investigative powers. He gave him carte blanche to do anything he wanted, and he was in complete charge of this investigation, and he could arrest or investigate anyone, including ministers of state. And Mueller had, toward the end of the war, tremendous power. Although he always was modest, he never let his picture be in the papers. He was went around in civilian clothes, didn't wear his SS uniform, and basically was very democratic with his staff and was not a very pompous individual, didn't drive around in big limousines and so forth. And he did his job right up to the last day, basically.
All right, fine. We're going to have to take a break here. And, of course, a little later in the program, we'll take your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I just wanted to mention the book that has been written, Mr. Douglas has written, on the Kennedy assassination, a fascinating, fascinating book which we carry. It's called Regicides, R-E-G-I-C-I-D-E. It's the story of the assassination and why it was carried out from the point of view of the CIA hierarchy. And, of course, it's based upon information that was given to Mr. Douglas by the Director of Covert Operations or the Assistant Director of Covert Operations at the Central Intelligence Agency. And you have to understand why they felt that they had to murder the American president, why they had to remove him, what their thought process was and how they went going about doing it. This is the most amazing book because it's the first book that's been written based upon information that came from within the CIA. There's so many books that have been out there that have been written simply to confuse you. In fact, I'm sure the CIA enjoys having a lot of books because the more books there are, the more confusion. So if you'd like to get the book Regicide, we carry it here at Radio Liberty. And we also have a four-tape set on the Kennedy assassination. We have a four-tape update on the Kennedy assassination. We have a book on 110 dead witnesses. It's called The Dead Witnesses, going into the background of what really happened and what happened to so many of the people who witnessed one or another aspect of the Kennedy assassination. And we even have something we call the Kennedy Assassination Special. Because if people don't understand what happened back there in 1963, and then, of course, how the media and the CIA and the FBI and everybody in government covered it up, it's really impossible to understand what's going on in America today. Again, the number to call if you'd like to get this information, 1-800-5-HIV, WAR. A very important book is called AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic. Actually, it's a book I wrote back in 1991 that tells you the story of the politics of the AIDS epidemic and the fact that doctors have been blocked at every turn from doing what was really necessary to stop the spread of this horrible plague, both in the United States and throughout the world. AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, it gives you my story of my effort working with an organized medicine, the fact that the doctors of the state of California consistently voted and supported an effective public health policy, and at every turn their efforts were frustrated by those working with an organized medicine both at the state and national level, and the tragedy is that people are dying in America today unnecessarily. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, because you need to understand the background of this epidemic to understand what is really happening medically in America today. Well, Dr. Stan Back here, our guest this afternoon is Mr. Gregory Douglas. His book we're talking about is Gestapo Chief, which we also carry. We also carry his book Regicide, because we think they're both important books, and they're simply historical documents. They're the sort of books you're not going to hear about from Barbara Walters or Dan Rather, at least not ordinarily, and yet they're an important part of history. And as Thomas Jefferson said so well, any nation that thinks it can live both free and ignorant in a state of civilization expects what never was and never will be. You have to understand what happened in the past, and that so much of you, what you believe has simply been created by the people who control the media. Well, we've got Fred calling in from Salinas. We weren't going to take any calls, but as long as Fred called in, I will take his question, and then we'll ask you to hold your questions until after the half hour after that. But Fred, did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I did. I was wanted to ask your guest. I have just read some documents. I had always heard that, you know, at the end of the war that the German scientists, some had come this way and some had gone to Russia. I've just read a document that that said that a lot of the scientists that had gone to Russia were sent back from Russia back over to here to work in our space program. Has he ever read anything about that?
Well, there would, I think it's a matter of timing and age. I think people who were old enough to be scientists and effective ones in 1945, when the Russians grabbed some of them, and many of them, some of them went voluntarily and some were simply seized. The people who developed the flying saucer, half the team went to the Russians, the other half came here. That's Habermal, Mita, and Melanzo. We got one of them and the rest of them went to Russia. The prototype was picked up by the Russian flying saucer. The one that was built over here was A.V. Roe in Canada. But the don't forget, when the Soviet Union would never let go of anybody of any value, but when they
what I was reading was people that come right out of Peenemünde and
The Peenemünde, a lot of the Peenemünde people, they'd moved south, but a lot of them were captured by the Russians. Some came to us. But as far as releasing them is concerned, I wouldn't think so. But by the time they were available for repatriation or to go back again, I would imagine they'd be pretty old, because Russia fell apart in 1990-91.
No, this was right in 1945.
Well, I don't think the Russians would ever have released anybody in that time. Those were people who were very, very important to them. And unless they were useless individuals or people who were only minor technicians, I think the great bulk of those people would have stayed in Russia.
Fred, why don't you just send that over to me, would you please?
Get a hold of you and
all right.
You see this.
You get that to me. Anything else you want to ask?
No, that's it.
All right, thank you so much. And we'll get hold of it and look at it. And if there's any question, we'll check again with Mr. Douglas. But he has information from all over the world and tremendous opportunity to get to answer many of these unanswerable questions. And he just has compiled fabulous amounts of information. And actually, the book on Heinrich Müller is, we're offering volume one. There's volume two, which is out of print, volume three. And then there's a fourth volume, which is the journals, which were actually kept by Heinrich Müller. And it's so important that you have access to the official documentation. Most Americans find it very difficult to believe that the head of the Gestapo came to California and lived in Piedmont. Piedmont, for those of you across America, is one of the more prosperous, very luxurious parts of the Bay Area, where I was raised, adjacent to Oakland and San Francisco. But really, right out of Oakland itself. So then, of course, when Heinrich Mueller was in Germany, my understanding, of course, that after the attempt on Hitler's life, he simply arrested a number of German generals were involved, and they must have tortured them terribly to get the confessions, and then simply executed them. Is that the case?
No, they didn't really have to torture anybody. The physical torture was forbidden. And the only time a man could be struck with a stick was if Mueller had given written permission in front. But basically speaking, they basically opened up and told everybody everything. A lot of these people were not used to being locked up, and Mueller was very skillful at interrogation. So in the main, first of all, there weren't anywhere near as many people arrested as the post-war writers and German writers want you to think. And the handful of people who were executed was about 200. They had several thousand people being interrogated at one or two times or other. But most of the individuals who were picked up pretty well confessed what they'd done.
All right, now was Rommel part of that movement?
No, Rommel wasn't. Rommel simply didn't. He felt the war didn't deserve to be ended. And his top aide, General Speidel, took it upon himself to pull Rommel into the conspiracy without bothering to tell Rommel. Of course, Rommel paid for this later. He was forced to commit suicide, but Rommel himself had nothing to do with it. He wasn't that type of person. He didn't approve of the war, the way the war was going, and felt that peace should be made, but he wasn't involved in any active conspiracy, so stories that he was are basically just post-war puffery.
But somebody had said he was. And that's
oh, yes, General Speidel said, right. Yes, well, Rommel was involved in this, and then, of course, that horrified Hitler, but the thing is, and then, you know, they decided to give Rommel a chance to kill himself rather than be tried for anything, and he did that, but he wasn't involved in it. I mean, he knew that these sort of things were going on, but he had no active part in it.
All right, fine. Well, now, were there any efforts to have peace? In other words, were any of the Germans working to try to get peace before the war ended?
Oh, yes. There were a number of these people, mostly aristocratic individuals or people who'd been in the Foreign Office or people who were mostly the upper class in Germany who didn't like Hitler anyway, who were trying to do this. There weren't an enormous number of them, but there were you know, a number of them here and there that were doing this, and they were, you'd find in any government, any country, people who were opposed to the government's position, and they were making efforts to do this. And of course, no one would listen to them. The British didn't want anything to do with them. The Americans wouldn't talk to them. The order was unconditional surrender. They would not surrender. In other words, the German, if they had taken control, it would have been done any good anyway, because the order went out from Roosevelt that they would not listen to them no matter what they did. And Churchill agreed with them, so that if they had killed Hitler, there would have been no peace with them, so they would have been wasting lives anyway.
And, of course, what they really wanted was, of course, to surrender to the West so that they wouldn't...
Yeah, well, now, there were different groups. There was the Operation, Kinnikrats, which was formed in the SS Foreign Legion office, and this was a plan, and Stauffenberg was involved with that, to surrender to the Russians. The Russians were very interested. Stalin was very interested in getting into the Ruhr and capturing the German major industrial centers. He could get Silesia, but he wanted the Ruhr, and the only way he could do that was if he could get in through the back, because the Allies were moving. After the avalanche broke out, they were moving quickly into that area, and Stalin wanted it, so that's one of the reasons Stauffenberg put the bomb in Hitler's headquarters, because if Hitler was killed, the Russians would come through. Now, this was very much... A number of German officers, by the way, had been working with the Russians, the Soviet government, in the interwar years, training the German army. That was permitted. The Russians let them try planes and so forth. So there was a good deal of friendship between many of the older German officers and the Russian military. So they weren't that hostile to them. But Stalin wanted to get in there, and he wanted the Germans to let him get through, and that's why they tried to kill Hitler, and of course it didn't work. Hitler survived, and the war went on. But a lot of people wonder what the motivations are. Well, it was split. Some people opposed Hitler intellectually, some opposed him politically, a lot of people didn't want the war. It was actually the cities were being bombed flat, many people were being, civilians were being killed. But there wasn't any chance. You see, the Allies would never have made peace with them. It would be the minimum, no matter what they'd done, if they seized the government from Hitler and declared themselves to be the new Germany, they would never have been, never would have been dealt with. They would, the only sole or the aim of the coalition at that time was to destroy everything in sight. The Russians, Stalin was much more of a pragmatist than that. Stalin realized that he'd have to get along with the Germans if he wanted someone to run his factories. So he was a little more flexible, but the others weren't. Roosevelt and Churchill were inflexible. They were going to destroy everything in Germany and kill everybody. And there would be no peace made until they were all dead or in jail. And so, as I say, the 20th of July was a disaster for everybody.
Amen to that. And, of course, the same thing was true with Japan. And even though the Japanese wanted to surrender, why we wouldn't. Did you ever get into that aspect of it?
Yeah, I've gotten interested. I did a paper on Dr. Ishii, which is kind of entertaining. Dr. Ishii was head of the Genpei, the Japanese secret police, bacteriological warfare station in Manchuria. And he was personally responsible for releasing bubonic plague and other things in China to see how many people they could kill. And they had practiced on live prisoners of war, allied prisoners of war, and killed quite a few of them.
And some of them were Americans as well.
Oh, yes, Americans. And when they captured Ishii, he would have naturally been a candidate for the gallows because he was a nasty man. But MacArthur decided that the time would come when we might want to loosen the plague on the Russians, so they decided to save Ishii's butt, and they set him up in Tokyo, MacArthur did, in a pharmaceutical company, brought all of his aides with him. And the gross thing about this was that Ishii was brought to the United States and lecturing on bacteriological warfare at Fort Detrick, Maryland, to a large assemblage of officers.
And really, one of the most evil men of all time.
Oh, he was awful. He wasn't sadistic about it. He simply killed all these people just to see how long it took them to die. And they tested everything on him. He died in Japan, a very wealthy man. Nobody touched him.
I know. Well, of course, people have to understand there really is evil, and it's not simply always on the side of the enemy. We'll be right back here in just a few moments with our special guest, Mr. Gregory Douglas. Well, this is the time when we want to mention some of the items we carry, and certainly if you have children or grandchildren in government schools, our first suggestion is get them out. The second thing is if they haven't been taught to read in government schools, you need to teach them to read phonetically. And, of course, we have a special program for that. It's called Phonopoly. It's 5 board games, 2 bonus games, and then, of course, 2 books that we throw in to explain to you that there's been an organized effort to dumb down the American children, and they've done a pretty good job, as it can be seen by the SAT scores. And what we see is not accidental, it's planned. So if you'd like to get the Phonopoly program, Phonopoly set, and most of these are $300 or $400, this is $139.95 plus shipping, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and then we have the Robinson homeschool curriculum that will take your children from first grade all the way up to graduation from high school. All the texts, all the tests, all the lesson plans are there. They're all on computer disks, 22 computer disks, including a complete 1911 British Encyclopedia Britannica and the 1913 Noah Webster's Dictionary, and so many books. The only ones you have to buy will be the books, the Saxon math textbooks. If you'd like to get information or you'd like to get what I think is an excellent homeschooling program, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the Robinson Homeschool Curriculum. And then, of course, if you'd like to get more information on outcome-based education, the plan of what's going on in the education system, give us a call and ask for the 4-tape set on outcome-based education or the book on OBE. But call right now. Have you ever wondered what the Vietnamese War was really all about? Why America, the most powerful nation in the world, spent 10 years fighting in Southeast Asia against a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and America lost that war? Do you really believe that happened by accident? There's so much to the story of Vietnam that the American people have never really known. And in our 4-tape set,
Vietnam, The Untold Story, you're going to get the information that you need to understand the tragedy of that event. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for Vietnam, The Untold Story, the story of what really happened in Vietnam that has been suppressed from the American people for the last 20 years.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this afternoon, Mr. Gregory Douglas, we're talking about his book, Gestapo Chief, and it's the story of Heinrich Mueller. If you're out there in the listening audience, out across America, the telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or out across America at here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Well, was Heinrich Mueller then employed by the American Central Intelligence Agency, or was he employed by some of the other intelligence agencies?
Well, on paper, he was employed by the Army, but in fact, he was employed by the CIA. There has been a discussion between the Army, myself, and other people on who was to be blamed for him, but basically the CIA was his controller. The man who controlled him is still alive. He lives in Williamsburg, Virginia. His name is Critchfield, James Critchfield. He was the man in Germany that was the controller of the Galen organization, and he had, at one time, at least, been the man who handled Mueller.
All right, fine. And so then, of course, they used the information that the Mueller had about the communists, and of course, then did he have any contacts, any spies that they could utilize behind the Iron Curtain?
To a degree, yeah. The specialty of Galen, who was another CIA man, was the same military intelligence, battlefield intelligence, some 32nd Russian Panzer Division or something, which was not Mueller's specialty. Mueller's was the political and the espionage, which is, of course, why he was much more valuable than Galen. And yes, they did have some people in place, and yes, they did use them. Russia was very hard to get agents into, and the Russians were very tough on anybody they caught. Obviously, they'd shoot them. So having agents in place inside the Soviet Union wasn't as important as a thoroughgoing knowledge of their methods and techniques. That was what Mueller was specialized in.
And, of course, General Galen was the head of, or at least involved with military intelligence.
Military intelligence,
and, of
yeah.
course, he has a book out. We have that in our library. And, of course, he then, after serving the Nazis, served the United States, and then I think he ended up as in charge of the West German intelligence.
Yeah, the West German Bundesnachrichtendienst, the BND, which was the German equivalent of the CIA, the Bundesamt für Verfassungsschutz, or the Government Agency for Defense of the Constitution, is the equivalent of the FBI. They're parallels, exactly.
All right, fine. Now, you mentioned, of course, that we brought some of the people over here who had been involved with the German flying saucer programs. What was that all about?
Well, they had developed in Germany aeronautically. They were working on aeronautical programs, and the flying saucer, the so-called Fliegende Scheibe, or the flying disc, was developed by the Germans, and they had a prototype in 1943, one prototype, which could fly very, very fast, 7,000 kilometers an hour, which is pretty quick. And there were three major people, Habermal, Mitte, and Melanzo. And Melanzo was Italian, and these people worked in Germany on this, and they worked actually outside of Prague in the protectorate there. And so when the Russians came in, the Russians got the prototype. One of them went to the west, one of them went to the east, and the other one disappeared. So the fellow that came to the west brought his plans with him, and the U.S. did build these. Some of them were over at Moffett Field over there near in Mountain View, in your area. And my publisher, Mr. Bender, actually saw one and photographed it there. It was marked A.V. Row on it, a capital A, capital V Row. So they called it the Avro Company. And they were located basically in the United States and Canada. They did build some prototypes.
Now, why have they lied to the American people for so many years?
Well, the government has a tendency to lie about everything. And, you know, and a lot of people see huge conspiracies everywhere. And in fact, many of these conspiracies are due basically to bureaucratic stupidity. And that's basically what it is. And having made a still stupid mistake, they won't admit it. And they spend more time trying to cover it up than they do saying, yes, we made a mistake. We dropped a bomb in the wrong town, or we let something out, which we shouldn't have. At one time, the Army was spraying chemicals around the Bay Area there to see how long it took for diseases to spread, and unfortunately, the stuff they were spraying was basically harmless, but if you had any kind of heart trouble, it would kill you.
Yeah, that was the serratia that then, I know that one man died down at Stanford University. They had this tremendous outbreak of serratia shortly after that spraying that took place.
Yeah, and I used to work at the hospital at Stanford, so I know about that. I also know there was an outbreak of pneumonic plague that nobody knows where it got started, and you were saying something earlier, which I thought I'd comment on. A friend of mine's father is a virologist, and he had done a lot of work on the family structure, so-called, of various communicable diseases. In other words, tracing it back here and there, and it can be done. He said, there's only one interesting thing about AIDS is it has no family background. It just suddenly became.
Well, we know that the government actually was working on that.
Oh, yes. There was a laboratory down in Haiti. The U.S. Navy had a medical experimentation system down there, and apparently they were testing this out on Haitians who were very, very poor, and for $5 a day you can get somebody to do almost anything, and apparently it got out into the community, and a number of Haitian prostitutes who were sent over to service the Cuban troops in Angola had it, and it got that way, spread that way, and then it got back in the Caribbean. Dr. Hazeltine, I don't know if you know who
He was at Harvard.
Papers on this, and he said, interestingly enough, he said that AIDS can be spread by mosquitoes. And his I have a copy of the paper which he prepared. He's head of the Tropical Institute of Miami, a very reputable man.
Oh, this is not the one from Harvard, then?
No. All right. I've got it somewhere. He wrote the position paper, and I was going to publish it, and then nobody wanted to do it. And then somebody told me it meant a good idea to do that.
Well, of course, the whole idea was that, you know, we don't want the American people to realize that we've got this terrible, terrible communicable disease out here that's going to kill hundreds of millions of people throughout the world.
Well, you know, the idea is that, you know, the original intention for AIDS, or actually HIV, it wasn't to kill people, it was to lower their immune system to the point where before you launched an attack, let's say on Cuba or some other place, they could catch influenza, or they could catch German measles, rubella or something, and their immune system would be so depressed by this new disease they were working on that the soldiers would all be sick. It wasn't to kill them, it was to incapacitate them, but then this thing mutated as being a retrovirus. And it turned into something very ugly. Now, can you imagine the government saying, yes, we developed AIDS?
Well, it's like they don't want to admit that they gave 98 million Americans a cancer-producing virus in the polio vaccine. That's in fact, there was an article even about it last week in the Wall Street Journal, but my latest newsletter deals with that. But they can't admit that because people would never trust the government.
Well,
again,
they don't. First of all, there is one thing I have to say this, and I'm, you know, patting you on the back, but I mean this sincerely. If it wasn't for the alternative newspapers and the alternative radio stations, and especially the Internet, we would know nothing. We would know only what the media told us to believe. And it's these alternative sources that sometimes they're wrong. Sometimes their theories aren't right. Sometimes they don't agree with them. But the fact is, the more concrete information that you put out there, somebody said to me, a friend of mine who's a Jesuit priest told me one time, he said there are three aspects of it. There is one side, there's the other side, and then there's the truth. And, you know, the idea is that you can't form an opinion until you have as much input as possible. So with the media pretty much under control, because after all news stories come from the Associated Press. Don't forget that. The Santa Cruz paper down there does not have a reporter in Washington and Switzerland and in Moscow. They take their copy right off the wire. So if the wire copy comes in, they take that and print what they're given. So in that sense, the central dissemination point for the bulk of the news in the United States comes from the Associated Press. And therefore, it would be an extremely easy business, since the Associated Press is a private organization made up of newspaper people, to get stock in it, and then you can say, no, don't put the story out and kill it. Now, you can put it out, and you have listeners. And the Internet, they hate the Internet, by the way. They absolutely loathe the Internet because they can't shut it off. Now, a lot of the stuff on the Internet, to me, is nonsense, but there's a lot of fact there. There's a lot of very valuable information. I myself get up on and look at the websites of various foreign newspapers, like the London Times, the Manchester Guardian, the Paris Soir, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, Pravda in Russia has interesting articles. You don't see any of that information over here, yet you'll find it up on the Internet, where you can go and look at it. And then once people realize they can do this, then all of the media blitzes they have in this country, well, we're going to do this, this is where we're going to blame the FBI for 2001, and that's what the president wants, we'll do this, that's dissed, because people can see this, and they don't want anyone looking at this, so they can't stop it, but they love to.
Well, I think
shut off anybody who counters them.
Well, I think that there's an entirely different outlook in Europe, for instance, as to what really happened on September 11th last year anything you're going to get here in the United States.
Well, you see, the thing is, the major news organs are controlled by a small group of people, and if the government says to them, for example, Mr. Zuckerman, who owns U.S. News and World Report. I know the editor of his magazine, and I gave him a story, and she said, well, you know, Mr. Zuckerman doesn't approve of this because the White House doesn't like it, so it's not going to be run. Now, that's how it is, because the White House has a great deal of power, and maybe the president isn't very effective, and maybe he's not worth much of anything, but still there is the power inherent in the presidency.
Well, the people who surround the president really, I think, run things.
Oh, of course, especially the one we've got in there now.
Right, Mr. Bush, for all the truth of the matter, is simply a figurehead for the power elite behind him. I think probably one of the people who's really pulling the strings would be Cheney.
Cheney, you know, you see, Wright Mills wrote a book called The Power Elite, which I recommend to people. It's a very good book. And these power elites exist everywhere in all societies, and it's not just unique to the United States. And they fluctuate. Sometimes it's the agriculture business. Sometimes it's the steel business. Sometimes it's the various ethnic groups. Sometimes it's a combination of them. Sometimes it's something else. But the government is not run by the legislators. They are responsive. But there, you know, how much it costs to run for the Senate? What, $9-10 million? You know, where's a man going to get that money to pay back his assistants and pay back the people who give it to him? Let's say he gets $10,000 from this company and $10,000 from that to run. Well, he owes them.
Well, of course, here in California, it costs $50 or $60 million. In fact, we had Mr. Huffington, Michael Huffington.
Oh, I remember him. Oh, yes, he had no more brains than a spoon. And the only thing he had going for him was his wife.
Right, and a fabulous fortune.
Oh, a lot of money.
Of course,
oh, yes.
It turned out, of course, when after he ran and was defeated in the general election, he announced that he was gay and left his wife for his boyfriend. And he would have been the Republican senator from California if he had won.
I'll tell you something that may shock you, but when I went in the voting booth to vote for him, here we had Dianne Feinstein at one side, and we had Huffington on the other. Now, at that time, I was a Republican, straight-ticket Republican. And yet, Dianne Feinstein would have represented the state of California a lot better than Mr. Huffington would.
Well, I think...
I know she's very liberal, and there's a lot of other things, but she's still an effective legislator. He's useless.
I know. Well, we're going to be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there listening to our program and you believe that there's a problem and you'd like to become part of our team, helping us as 5 hours a day, and then, of course, on two programs in the weekend, we reach out on various networks, bringing the news behind the news, the story behind the story. We hope that many of you will decide right today you're going to join that Radio Liberty family of supporters. And for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, you'll get our 4 best tapes of the month, you'll get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, you're helping us do what we do. And, of course, if you don't get involved, who will? If not now, when? We are losing our freedom. We're moving, in my estimation, very rapidly towards a surveillance society with videos in every store, videos on every street corner, videos, cameras on our highways, watching people. We have the new program called TIPS, where they're going to have people informing on other Americans, of course, in the name of fighting terrorism. They're going to use all of our driver's license as part of a federal ID program, and you can go up on my website and get all of the things. They're listening to our programs, listening to our what's going on in the church services. They actually are listening to our telephone broadcasts, to echelons violating the laws, having the Canadians or the British listen to telephone calls here, and we listen to them in Canada and Great Britain. We are moving towards the loss of all freedom. If you are concerned, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARM. Because freedom once lost will never be regained.
Our four-tape set on the JFK assassination includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination, a two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of the American president, and then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out, and if you listen to this four-tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination tapes.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here, our guest is Mr. Gregory Douglas. Oh, he has two books that we carry. One is Regicide, and it is, of course, the assassination of President Kennedy from the point of view of one of the men who planned this, and his name was, well, he was the assistant deputy director in charge of covert operations, and it's a fascinating insight into the rationale behind the murder of an American president. And then, of course, the second book is called Gestapo Chief. It's the story of Heinrich Mueller, and we'll have all of the books available here, but right now we're carrying the one that we've reviewed today. Going into the background, this gentleman is very pragmatic, Nazi man. He joined the Nazi party, I think, because he was told to join. Wasn't that really what happened?
Yeah, in 1939, when the war broke out, Himmler basically told his top people. Mueller had not joined the party at that time. In fact, never supported any of their charity drives or anything, and in fact, he was still a practicing Catholic. And Himmler was simply told him if he expected to maintain his office, he was going to have to, A, stop going to church, and B, he's going to have to join the party. So he did. Of course, he never really left the church at all, but he didn't go to the services anymore. He'd been a member of the Bavarian People's Party, which was a Catholic-based church, a very conservative, nationalistic group. And nevertheless, it was not it wasn't tolerated, and any other parties were tolerated in Germany. So Mueller simply was betwixt and between. But then when the war broke out, he had to do this. So he did join the party in 1939.
And so he was really a very, very pragmatic individual. He wanted to have a high position and wield the power. And so he did what was necessary to get there.
Well, he was an ambitious man, but he was a very quintessential professional policeman. You'd find him anywhere at any time. He didn't involve himself in the political aspect of anything. He didn't let his personal feelings get in the way of business, of the work he was doing. He was basically reasonably tolerant of people, and people who knew him and worked with him said that he was actually quite decent. But he was very tough. At the end of the war, when the war was obviously lost, by his order, the people who had been arrested and tried and convicted of treason in the in the bomb blast thing were waiting in prison. They thought they'd be released. Mueller had his men go take them out and shoot them. He said, "They will not survive us." And he did do this. He's openly admitted it several times. He did this himself.
Oh, of course, yeah. You know, the idea that we tried all the war criminals is just ridiculous. You know, that is for the general population who honestly believes that everything is right and wrong and good and bad, black and white. But the reality is that the people who led our country during the Second World War and the people who lead our country today, many of them are pragmatic, without any sense of right and wrong. But we can't let the public know that.
Mueller said to me one time, "The higher you get in the government, the less morals you have until you're at the very top, and then you're totally amoral, he said, because he's seen this happen time after time. You can start out as a well-meaning man, and if you stay that way, you don't last very long. You simply have to put everything to one side and say, this is state policy, this is for the benefit of the people, we're doing it, they don't really know what they're doing, so it's okay to push this off on them. Now, the one thing they're afraid of, in this government and any government, is an informed public, and they're afraid that the general thing is the right wing and the left wing fight with each other. They throw mud at each other, and there's a good deal of this going on, but it's off in the corner somewhere. The public is in the middle sleeping like a big hibernating bear, and you know it's very ill-advised to run into the den of the bear and start kicking him, because the bear wakes up and eats you, and that's the one thing they don't want the public getting annoyed, so they go to great lengths to keep everybody happy. That a movie I recommend to anybody, it's a satire, but it's very true, is called Wag the Dog. A very interesting thing about manipulation by the media, or how the media and the government manipulates the situations, and how the public is subjected to these script-writing news stories. I had a friend of mine who used to be a TV anchorman at San Francisco Channel 7 News, and he used to refer to the news staff as the news readers. He said, we're given a script, and we're told what to read, and we do not deviate from it. They don't sit there and make those stories up, and they don't get them off the press. They're handed these scripts before they go on. They're there, the readers there. They read the news. They read what they're told to read. And this is KGO, I think Channel 7 in San Francisco. I've been in the newsroom. I've seen this done. They read what's given to them. They're script readers. They're actors.
I had a friend of mine who was on KGO radio, and I was on his program once, so maybe 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And he said, off the air, he said, you know, if I said on this radio station what I really believe, I'd be off the air tomorrow.
Yeah, he'd then we be
went
fired.
Went back on the air, and he said, you know, if anybody told me what to do here and what to say on this radio station, I would quit tomorrow. And they looked over at me and winked.
Because that's exactly right. I uncovered a major fraud at Stanford University. Some Rodin statues were being pushed off as genuine and used as tax write-offs. And I discovered this is a $3 million fraud. And I started writing about it. And, oh, my God, I was threatened by every lawyer in Los Angeles and everyone else. And we were going to put this up on the channel. That's how I got acquainted with Mr. Jensen. And he said to me, well, we're not going to run the story on the Rodin fakes, because they are fakes. They're provable fakes. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, one of the directors of ABC's wife has five of them, so you know that's not going to go anywhere but into the laboratory. And I said, well, that's the end of that story. He said, oh, so many of them end up down there.
Well,
and that's what happens.
Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling in from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. You have a question or comment?
Yeah, just two of them. The first one's a quickie, since you use the word pragmatic so often. Now, every person I'm aware of that word has been used of has been a nasty person. So do you agree that it's an inherently pejorative word?
Well, I think it just simply describes it describes a sort of a ruthless self-serving sort of person. In a sense, yeah, you're right. I mean, it isn't meant as a compliment. It's meant as a descriptive phrase, and it's not meant to praise a person, but merely to describe their attitudes.
Now, I think, Roger, that basically it's a person who'll do anything to get ahead, who has no necessarily principles. He's not dedicated to the right or the left. He's just dedicated to his personal advancement, and so he's pragmatic. He's an unprincipled person. But this is true of most of our politicians and so many people within the media, and certainly we see this, the pragmatic approach within business today, which is why we're in the trouble we are. Anything else? What's your second question?
I would be fascinated if you had any opinions on the way Albert Speer was locked away from any media interviews of any sort after the Nuremberg trials, and I just conclude it was to make sure that he didn't sing on all those internationalist One Worlder Burger connections that he must have had.
All right, let's get to Mr. Douglas. Thank you so much. And the question is the locking away of Mr. Speer.
Well, Speer was locked up because he was minister of munitions, and he was very effective. He was another pragmatic man. As soon as the war was over, he said, you know, I had nothing to do with that. I really tried to kill Hitler. And then he proceeded to sell fake Hitler drawings that he made himself. Speer was a very intelligent, capable man. He was absolutely brilliant as Minister of Munitions. He had been an architect, and he was able to rationalize the production programs in Germany. But I don't think that he was locked up because of that. But I will say this, from my own knowledge and digging into the Swiss records, you know, the Germans were carrying on, the Third Reich was carrying on business with the United States and England, but mostly the United States, right up to the last week of the war. The U.S. would ship stuff into Switzerland, and that would be sold to Germany. The Germans would send material to the Swiss, who would then sell it to the Americans.
But you see, we can't let the American people know that we were trading with the Germans all during
the war. We were trading with them right up to the very end. IBM, I have a nice photograph of Mr. Watson, who formed IBM. He's sitting in an opera box with Hitler wearing the Order of the German Eagle. That's something the IBM people would rather not talk about.
Right, or Henry Ford.
Or Henry Ford, who got the same medal, or Charles Lindbergh, who got the same one. There was an enormous amount, and as soon as the war was over, the Dulles brothers, especially John Foster, he worked for Sullivan in New York, and they immediately got I.G. Farben its money back. The Kennedy family was heavily invested in I.G. Farben, the huge chemical and dye complex in Germany. It was allegedly broken up as a Nazi organization, but it was put back together again, and they got their stock back. You see, we're seeing this now, but we're seeing it so clearly that it's not some of the things that's hidden in some strange publication. We're seeing the collapse of the corporate structure in the United States based upon their crooked activities, and the president is sort of right in this right up to his eyeballs with his Harkin stock and other things. They don't care about their stockholders, like Ley. At the very last, when Ley knew that his company, which was a fraud to begin with, was collapsing, and he knew it was going down the drain, he encouraged his employees to buy more stock. And he himself sold all his stock. He pulled $300 million out of this thing, and he's never going to give one penny of it back. Look at all the people who worked for him for years and were loyal to him. He knew they were going to lose their 410Ks. He knew they were going to lose their pension plans, and he made no effort to stop them, and he took his money and went off with it.
And, of course, he was very close to the current administration.
Oh, I have some letters. I have some letters, about 120 letters written between himself and Mr. Bush, which are all going to go in my book on 9-1-1. And it's very easy to see from this how they ate from the same hog trough. And you know, you can't have any respect for people like that because they're not honest. There are honest businessmen, and there are honest politicians. I knew Sam Nunn casually, and I think Sam Nunn is a very fine man. There are politicians that are decent people, and there are, and blaming the CIA and blaming the FBI for these things, that's ridiculous. There are many, many people in these agencies who are very high-minded, patriotic Americans. It's the leadership. The American people do not deserve their leadership. They do not deserve it.
Well, I hope that we can get the American people informed and incensed, and we can awaken that sleeping
Well, we've got the midterms coming up in November now. People who don't sit on their hands and say, I don't like either side, if they continue with this attitude, they're going to get worse. They have to get up there and vote for people that they regardless, but you have to vote.
Amen to that. Well, God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us, and it's been a fascinating, fascinating hour. I'm sure our listeners have appreciated it. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. That was Mr. Gregory Douglas. Remember his books, Regicide, and, of course, Gestapo Chief, both available from Radio Liberty here. And so this is the time we ask you to pray for America. Because behind all the things that are going on, behind all the foes applauded, behind them, all the saints have planned, and behind the schemes of men and demons is a higher hidden hand. We're involved in a spiritual battle, ladies and gentlemen, and this is what you have to understand. There's always been a conspiracy against God, and believe me, it's being waged very effectively today. Look it up, Jeremiah 11:9 and Ezekiel 22:25, and of course, pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers. Pray for revival in America. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until next week, till I guess tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.